You're on the Plants Grow Here podcast. I'm Daniel Fuller. Come along with me as we enter a hidden world of deep horticultural, ecological, and landscape gardening knowledge with featured experts, industry professionals, and enthusiasts. Everybody's talking about planting more trees, but not enough people are talking about how to plant trees and look after them properly. Jason Summers is the director for Remarkable Trees in Victoria, and he comes from a background in local council. In this episode, he's going to teach us what we're collectively getting wrong when it comes to urban tree care. On the Plants Grow Here podcast, we've talked about how to plant correctly, pruning basics, and other tree care related topics. But this episode breaks a lot of new ground, including the benefits of planting into tree trenches instead of tree pits, what trees need in order to grow quickly into strong, robust green infrastructure assets, and how to create ideal soil conditions so that when you dump 30,000 litres of water onto the base of a single tree, you don't lose a single drop to runoff. So welcome to the show, Jason.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be invited.
Yeah, it's going to be fun, mate. So can you tell us about your current role and how did you get there in your career path?
Ooh, okay, my current role. At the moment, I run a company that I started with my wife called Remarkable Trees, and it's been going part-time for about 5 years and the last 2 years full-time. Previous to that, I had a life in local government. I worked for two different councils out the north and the west of Melbourne. The first one was Broombank Council as a conservation officer, so managing a lot of natural areas, revegetation, lots of you know, controlled burns, all sorts of stuff, looking after grasslands, grassy woodlands, and riparian areas. And then I went across to Hume Council, which is more northerly of Melbourne, and I was there for about 18 years. Had a couple of jobs there, started off managing the tree crew and the bush crew as a coordinator, and then eventually ran the environment department for 18 months, and then became a manager of parks for 10 years. So, and then I saw a bit of a need in the industry for sort of high quality horticultural consulting and contracting, especially in the tree area. So I started doing a little bit of work on the side and sort of got a bit bigger than running a parks department and running a business is not something you can do for too many years in a row. I did it for three and then I started to go a bit insane. So something had to give. So I, right in the middle of COVID, I told my wife I was leaving a secure job at council to start my own business or our business, and we did it together. So that's what we've done. And, been going on full-time for over 2 years now and, doing a lot of different things. So pretty much I have a nursery where we grow trees and propagate trees and also supply. We install and plant establishment maintenance, and a fair bit of horticultural and arboricultural consultancy. So that's sort of what I've been up to and where I got to am now.
Yeah, fantastic. So it's always good to fill a need in the market rather than to just do what everyone else is doing, right?
Yeah, correct. Look, I see a lot of failed tree plantings over the years, with all with good intentions, people trying to do the right thing. But, there's a lot of steps involved in establishing a tree. And, getting the species selection right, getting good stock, planting it correctly, establishing it, formative pruning, and looking after it, ensuring that it becomes a mature tree is a fair journey. And most, there's always something that goes wrong in one of those steps. And if we can avoid that, we can get a lot more trees established at a higher success rate. So that's where I thought I could lend my years of experience of tree planting to help a lot more councils and developers and private people who need help with trees.
Yeah, totally. So in your opinion, like after all these years of experience, you've probably seen a lot of trees. What are some of the biggest landscaping and arboricultural mistakes that you see all the time, especially in like urban backyards and suburban backyards?
I think a lot of people don't put a lot of thought into the species selection, which I think is critical. I've removed a lot of blue gums out of single fronted, townhouses and had to take the tree through the house. because people just didn't realize how big they were going to grow in their backyard, which was, you know, 12 feet wide. And this tree's taking over about 5 foot of it in just the trunk. And it's, you know, massive. And to remove a big tree like that and take it out through the house is a fair task, and it's, you can do a lot of damage. So I think species selection is one. Planting sounds simple. Dig a hole, put a tree in, but a lot of people over-excavate the holes. And we see a lot of trees subsiding and then causing issues with the trees to establish. A lot of people probably, I mean, a lot of people don't realize that, you know, roots need oxygen. And so we need to make sure we don't bury them too deep, and we get the levels right. And we, you know, over-excavate the width of the hole and not the depth, to ensure. In fact, I like to make sure that when we excavate, we don't excavate any deeper than the root ball depth, which a lot of people don't measure. They just look at the pot and go, oh, yeah, that's 12 inches high. And actually, no, the root ball actually is only 8, because they only 3/4 fill the pot with potting mix. Or, you know, so that level thing is something that is often overlooked. And people go, oh, just throw a bit of soil in and pat it down, it'll be right. Yeah, it will, but it will subside, and then soil will wash on top of the root ball, and then the tree will have trouble establishing. So I see a fair bit of that. And also, a lot of people don't realize the competition for nutrients and mostly water from grass and trees. And so mulching trees out during establishment in as big as areas you can afford is good for the tree establishment. The grass will come and creep in later if you let the mulch die away in time. But if you can keep the grass competition away from establishing tree, it'll grow twice as fast. So I advocate big mulch rings, or even for avenues, temporary mulch lineal beds, where you actually have a 3 or 4 meter wide bed the whole length of the avenue. And people go, oh, that's a lot of mulch, that's a lot of work. It's like, yes, it is, but your trees will grow twice as fast, and they will establish better and have less competition from the grass. So that's you know, another common issue I see is grass growing up to trees and then trees not getting enough water. It's like having carpet or even lino on top of the root ball and the roots when you've got grass, because they get, the grass gets 80-90% of the water. The tree below that doesn't get enough water. Anyway, and a lot of people don't realize that for the first 6 to 12 months, most of the roots are still in the root ball. If you've excavated your hole properly, they'll grow out pretty quick. But if you've, like a lot of people do, shove it into a hole, and some people use augers or use inappropriate equipment where they glaze the side of the hole and the tree can't punch its whole roots through those glazed sides, is a real issue. So over excavating the width of the hole is a lot better, so that there's a nice fine soil for the roots to come out into. So when you're watering, you need to water in through the top of the root ball and not bury it with soil. There's a couple of things that I see that happen that can be easily fixed with just a little bit of knowledge and experience, and, you know, people knowing what they're doing. I like to see trees successfully establish, and so I like to get it right from the start.
Yeah. Imagine all the money these councils and homeowners are spending on all these trees that just die and then have to be replaced. Like, when you can just talk about these simple fixes, like dig a hole a little bit wider but no deeper.
Yeah, the little things. I think one of the challenges is a lot of people see it as, and it's no disrespect to gardeners, I'm a gardener too, but, you know, there's gardening and there's, you know, looking after an established garden, but there's, you know, when you're creating something from scratch, it's a very involved situation, and it doesn't hurt to ask. And, you know, people go, oh, I don't want to pay a horticulturalist, but, you know, you might have to pay them for a couple of hours of advice that will save you thousands of dollars. I see people who buy properties out this way where I live, out towards Gisborne, and they plan an avenue of down their driveway, and I go, well, that one's not going to last. And they put 50 trees in this kilometre-long driveway, and they all die.
And it's like, and 49, oh, they all die? Well, it's worse when you've got, you know, 47 of them live and 3 of them die.
Yeah.
Because they're all out of the wrong size and...
Yeah, oh, that can happen. I mean, but, yeah, when the whole lot dies because it's just a totally inappropriate species. Like, in council, I used to assess landscape plans, and, you know, sometimes the landscape plans that come from people from the east side of town don't understand the west side of town. And they are different, even though in the same city. I actually said to one person, I went through the landscape plan and there's red all over it, not going to work, change this. And the developer goes, what do I do? I said, well, you need to find a landscape architect who's actually been to the site and understands the conditions they're planting into. Because they wanted to plant silver birches out in Dermot next to a grassland. And it's like, they wouldn't last 5 minutes. The first 40 degree wind, the leaves would melt off. So it's, you know, it's so, it is so much drier and hotter out the west and the north of Melbourne. But yeah, and I actually rang the LA and said, have you actually been out to site? Oh, no, we haven't been out there. I said, I think you need to go out and have a look. Anyway, so I think they did change landscape architects on my recommendation and got a better plan done. And that one went through and the trees established because they put the right species in.
Well, there you go. Funny that.
Yeah, just.
So what about, you know, like councils? Like, are they making the same mistakes or are their mistakes different to what you're going to see in a residential setting?
Look, I mean, some councils have qualified people who do and, you know, have experience and know what they're doing. Some councils pay people to advise them on species. But they do make mistakes. I think the biggest mistake people make is they don't plant a tree proportionate to the space available for it. Like, my motto is plant the biggest tree you can fit in the available space, both above and below ground, because we need as much canopy as we can get. Because if you look at a city, the council probably controls 25, 30% of the land in all the roads and parks and sports fields. So even if the council planted up 80% of their land, which they probably can't, they still only get an overall canopy cover of around 10 or 15, 20%. It really relies on people in the private realm, homeowners, people who own car parks and commercial warehouses and factories, to actually use some of their land to plant trees for the same effort, because there's a lot more land in private ownership in that way than there is in public ownership. Even if you talk about utilities and other authorities. It's really a team. It requires everyone to do a bit. And I think, look, mistakes get made, in council. Usually it might be, in the past, a lot of the councils had their own nurseries, and a lot of the trees got planted were ones that were easier to propagate because the nursery grew them themselves. They didn't buy some of the hard-to-propagate trees because they couldn't grow them, and they weren't allowed to buy them from external sources. Now, a lot of those nurseries are now shut down. I think there's only about two councils left in Victoria that have their own nursery. You still got to be open-minded to say, well, if we can't propagate that, we'll get someone who can. So from that perspective, I think we need to, make sure that we're planting an appropriate tree for the location.
Right tree, right place, eh?
Yeah, it's a bit of a cliche, but I give an example. I was down at Point Cook the other day, and my son was playing cricket, and I decided to, I was out fielding, and I decided to go for a walk, get some steps up, and I walked around this park, and they had this massive shared path, and they had crepe myrtles next to it. And I go, that's a missed opportunity. Like, they're not going to provide any shade at all to the footpath ever. And it's, it can get quite hot and windy out there. And I thought, well, that, to me, crepe myrtle's a good infill for colour and a little bit, because they haven't got a lot of size about them. They could have put a large deciduous tree or a large evergreen tree in this location because there was plenty of space, plenty of room, no overhead power lines. And I think there's been a real missed opportunity. They've got, crepe myrtles and cherry trees. Like, it's like, to me, that's, I don't know, it would have looked really good along there with something like a stone pine, like a Pinus pinea or a Quercus avenue. it'll be there in 100, 200, or even with oaks 400 or 500 years time. I don't think there's a lot of forethought done by, I shouldn't blame landscape architects, but they do a lot of the designs, but people who come up with the species palettes for some of these projects. Some people go, we want quick growing things. I thought, quick growing things usually don't live that long, but so I like to have a mixture of slow growing old things, things that'll live there a long time, and some quick growing things, so you get your quick cover, but you get your long term cover that when all these other short lived things have died and been removed, you've got a structure and framework for the park or the street or whatever it is. I see a bit of that happening, and I think people need to, I don't know, I think in tree time with a lot of things I do, and what will this look like in 20, 30, 50, 100 years' time? So you see me planting a lot of oaks and figs and native stuff and exotic. I plant a lot of stuff in parks. So look at where you plant them. If you want afternoon shade, you need to put it in the northeast corner of the park or the playground. and where will the shadow be cast? Will it grow over the playground? Can we prune it above it? Will we create a really nice space here where people will want to sit for hours to watch the kids in the playground? At the moment, most playgrounds are like a shag on a rock, and they put shade sails, which are good temporarily and usually get vandalised, but nothing beats natural shade. Because trees can cool the air if they've got access to water. And that's, and they're like an air conditioner, so why not put more air conditioners in?
Totally.
Yeah.
You mentioned pruning there briefly, and I think that part of the job of, maintaining these trees is to prevent them from being malpruned, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, look, it's interesting. If especially in residential subdivision development, which I do a lot of work in, or residential streets, if you plant trees and don't prune them in a timely manner, the resident will, because they'll back out with their car and they can't see down the footpath or the road, and for safety reasons, they'll just get out. I've seen people just rip branches off. I've witnessed them.
Yeah,
but they don't even use secateurs. They just literally rip them off and don't care about the tree. So, timely formative pruning, canopy lifting, is vital for a tree. And in a 2-year maintenance program, it should be in year one and year two, and ideally, possibly even from the nursery if the stock's big enough. But it depends on the size of the stock you put in. But formative pruning is quite important. Canopy lifting for visibility and safety is important. You should be able to sit in a car or four-wheel drive and back out your driveway and see down the footpath clearly without running anyone over, and the road. And sometimes you can't because the tree's growing in that space, but when it grows up above it, then you can prune it up. So it's a progressive thing. But certainly pruning is a part of tree management. And if council or the authority or the developer, whoever, doesn't do it, then residents will take it in their own hands. So it's amazing how people will do what they want with the tree because they think it's their tree, but in reality it's actually the community's tree. It's on council land. It belongs to the whole community.
Mm-hmm.
But I've seen people cut them in half because they've got solar panels on the side of the house.
Oh.
And you come along and you look up and you go, and you'll see three trees all cut down or run over or pulled out by a four-wheel drive, and you look up and you go, oh, they put solar panels there last weekend. Oh.
Yeah.
Obviously didn't assess for their street trees here.
So I'm guessing that's a lawsuit, no?
Not really. I don't think it's worth a lawsuit. It's a difficult one because I don't think people realise that the little bit of shadow that those trees may cast on your solar panels are probably when the solar panels are at their least efficient in winter when the shadows are cast long. And you're not generating any power anyway. So in the full sun of summer, the sun's overhead and you'll still get plenty of power generated. Mm. But a lot of people, want to save the environment by cutting trees to generate solar power. It's quite ironic, really, isn't it?
Yeah, it is ironic when you put it like that, isn't it?
Yeah, it's funny. Oh, but anyway, I've seen it all over, 23 years of local government and the last couple in private practice. So, and I've heard all the excuses why people don't want a street tree in front of their house but anyway, that's all good. But look, trees are important, and as you look at most new housing subdivisions these days, there's not a lot of room for trees when you put a big house on a small block.
No.
So if it wasn't for the street trees and the park trees, there probably wouldn't be any trees in that whole estate or that suburb.
No.
So in the new suburb, it's becoming even more urgent to look after street trees and park trees because they will be the only trees, potentially.
Yeah, that's really true.
Well, some councils are now actually requiring developers to put a small tree in a courtyard or a setback from the street on the property as well as a street tree, which is good. And I think Brimbank is one I know that has that in their planning laws now, and I think the state government's trying to look at maybe bringing that into all unit developments because a lot of those 4 or 5 unit developments don't have any vegetation in them at all, and there are a lot of concrete. A lot of impervious surfaces, a lot of heat, and a lot of air conditioners running.
No, and that's not very attractive to renters or buyers, is it?
No, it's not. People are willing, there's studies show that people are willing to pay additional either rent or purchase price for a property with, well-treed suburb than a non-treed suburb because, it looks more attractive. It looks more established, and you feel safer in a well-treated environment. So, I think trees offer a lot of benefits more than people realise. Increase your property values too, and a lot of people don't realise that. When you explain that to residents about street trees, they look at them a little differently after that. Not all, some. Some you're not going to convince, right. But, you know. Yeah. Anyway.
So let's go back below the ground again now. We've got, you know, these tree pits, they call them in the city. But when you were having your talk recently at the AIH, you mentioned the term tree coffin. So can you tell us what's going on there below the ground when we plant, you know, it's just container gardening really, isn't it, with these giant trees?
Yeah, look, it is. It's restricting the tree's ability to grow once it fulfills that space. So I look at them, I mean, tree coffins is probably a bit drastic, but it gets the point across, I think. I like to use tree trenches where the tree pits or coffins, or whatever you like to call them, are actually joined together so the tree roots can explore and share resources. So from that perspective, yeah, if you put a tree in a tree pit and it's confined, it will only grow to that size of the, you know, rootable volume available. So the reality is to get a large canopied shade tree in a pit, you need a pit to be about 30 cubic meters of root volume. Now, that's a lot of root volume. And 30 cubic meters, if you think about it, and it's probably no more than a meter deep, is like, you know, 3 by 10 meters. So that's quite a big space. And to find that space underground without services or footings of buildings or whatever there might be is almost impossible in urban areas. But if you do long lineal trenches where you put either uncompacted soil or some other structural soils where you can compact the soil and tree roots can grow, you can actually get very good growth on your trees. And if you put water into the equation and drainage, you can actually get really quick growing trees that actually cool an urban space. So there's a few things that we can do beyond the tree pit to actually improve tree health and the cooling effect of trees.
Yeah, that's very clever.
Yeah, no, I sort of was lucky enough, about 12, 14 years ago, to get a scholarship through Parks and Leisure Australia to attend a conference in Toronto, in Canada. And it was International Society of Arboriculture Conference. And arboriculture is basically tree management. So I went across there, and I actually, when I thought about going there, I thought that's a long way to go for a conference. So I thought I'd made it into a study tour. So I caught up with some people from other cities on after the conference, and met up with lots of people and learnt lots of things over 3 week study tour that I organised.
Thank you.
at the conference, I caught up with a gentleman by the name of James Urban. And James Urban's a landscape architect, and he's done a lot of work on rooting volumes for trees using different medias in highly urbanized spaces to get good tree growth. And that figure of 30 cubic meters has been developed by him in conjunction with the City of Toronto. When you actually get trenches and put the trees together, you can actually reduce that by 20% because they can share space. So you can have smaller volumes per tree if you join all the trees up into a big long trench. So, the study tour, I was lucky enough to go to, I spent a week at Toronto at the conference, caught up with some people in the City of Toronto, had a look at the way they manage trees in their parks. And then I went to Chicago to the, Chicago Parks District, who manage all the parks in Chicago. Had a look at Millennium Park, Grant Reserve, the actual roof garden on top of City Hall in Chicago, which was quite an amazing experience. This is up 11 stories high. There's a roof garden with a meadow of wildflowers in it and bees and all sorts of stuff up there. It's pretty cool. And the city there advocate a lot for roof gardens. And the developers have worked out that if you put a roof garden on your building, any apartment that sees that roof garden, you can almost charge double for it. So because people want a green view from their apartment. So the roof gardens get paid for by body corporates. Everyone contributes towards the management of them in the building, but the builder gets a higher selling price because of the green views that the roof gardens offer some of the apartments. Not all of them, but a lot of them. So, yeah, this benefits of green are huge in development. I think developers now are starting to realise that if you can get things, create a sense of place and people want to be there, then they're willing to pay more for it. And that's sort of, you know, why they're starting to get into sort of higher quality landscapes. And some developers do it better than others. Some people do it to tick a box to be able to develop, and others do it to sell, you know, their marketing. but mm-hmm. In the end, it creates a sense of community and place, which I think, you know, if you're lucky enough to be in a development where they have done it well, then you get to enjoy the benefits of good parklands, good street trees, and all the benefits that come with it. Mm. So, yeah.
And that's the sort of place that people want to live. That's why we do this. Yes, the developer has to get paid, the builder has to get paid, everyone has to get paid. But at the end of the day, these are places where we live, and these are places where we raise our children. These are places where we meet our love, where we go on our first date.
Correct. We work there, we play. They're important places. And I think, I know of some subdivisions where people will pay a premium to live in that subdivision because it's got high quality parks, high quality street trees, and, you know, it's well designed and it's well maintained, and, you know, and that's a draw card, and the block prices, and the, you know, when they go for sale, they sell within 24 hours, and people pay a premium for them because they want to live in that estate because they've done it well. And I'm lucky enough to work on one of those, and you see a lot of others trying to emulate that, but they don't always get it. Some do, some, but not the majority, I suppose. Because it does take a lot of effort and a lot of expense, but I think the investment is well worth the returns that they get in the long term.
Mm.
Yeah.
Just going back to the tree trenches again, I know that there's a lot of freaky stuff that goes on underneath the soil, like in terms of, you know, trading nutrients and all that sort of stuff.
Yep, and moisture.
Is there a benefit to tree health by doing that, by providing those connections?
Yeah, look, there can be. If you can think about it, a lot of trees grow in forests or groves or groups. And what can happen, and you know, it depends on the species mix. If you've got similar species, they can actually root graft. So their roots can actually join up and they can share resources. I've seen examples, and I'll explain it to you an example. In forestry, in a plantation, during the 60s, they used to thin out trees, and they used to physically cut them down, and they wouldn't grow back because, you know, basically they had no light, and the other trees would grow fatter. And anyway, they tried chemical thinning of a few of these plantations, and some species are very sensitive because they root graft. They'd poison a line of trees, and the whole plantation would die.
Oh, jeez.
Because they're all connected, and they go, I don't think we should do that again. it could be quite expensive. But, you know, and I've even seen examples, and I've seen it myself, where trees have been removed in a row, and this was in a plantation at an arboretum up in Tumut in New South Wales, and the trees, whilst they were removed, they were still actively callousing over the stump. So they got these, like, bark on them. So they're actually getting nutrients and moisture from the other trees.
I've seen that too. It's crazy.
Yeah, and it's crazy weird. It's like, so it's connected to other living things, even though the top of the tree is removed. So it's like, so my short answer, or that's a long answer, but the short answer is yes, if they have similar species and they're connected through trenches or common space, if one tree happens to be inundated with water, it can actually move those resources through to other trees and share them. So, I mean, there's so much we don't know about trees. And I'm still learning myself. So, and that's pretty freaky when you think about it, you know. And if that tree that's inundated in water has root connection outside the water, then he can survive and still get oxygen sent to it through its roots as well, rather than die. So there's lots of benefits to this connection.
Yeah.
And I think this is the problem with humans. We compartmentalize everything and put everything in a box. I think if we do less of that, we'll have better outcomes. I always like to follow nature. Nature doesn't get it wrong very often. And I always say to people, don't mess with nature. You'll come back to bite.
That's right.
And I think it is at the moment with some of the stuff we've done over the years. So, but yeah, I don't know if that answers your question, but hopefully you've got some of it answered.
Yeah, it does. And I think there's also something around the mycorrhizae as well. I don't think you touched on that. Did you? Yeah, there's mycorrhizal connections as well that add another layer of complexity.
Well, yeah, I mean, mycorrhizae and fungi and bacteria can extend a root system of a tree, and they can help each other out. And that's something that's missing in a lot of urban soils is organic matter and, you know, that organic biodiversity. And there's ways you can add them into the soil through fertilizers and manures and composts, and also even creating compost teas where you actually take a real high-quality compost And if you're doing it for trees, you want a fungal dominant compost where you actually brew like a tea bag with compost in water with other nutrients, and you can actually exponentially expand the number of good fungi, bacteria, nematodes and stuff, and then use that to actually water in plants or soil and help with plant health. And it's sort of not a new area, but it's been part of similar, people call it regenerative agriculture, where we're working with nature to actually build up the biology in the soil. And I think that's something that is lacking in a lot of urban soils. Like we buy these soils that are either made from, you know, either mined from other sites, which may lose some of that bacteria and fungi during the transport or storage, because all these things require oxygen. And one of the things that actually kills these is, and farmers are starting to work this out, is superphosphate actually kills a lot of the bacteria and fungi in the soil. People think it helps with nutrients. It's a short-term thing. The bacteria and fungi actually can help break down and make available a lot of the nutrients in the soil that are not available, rather than having to add additional fertilizers. So there's a lot of research getting done at the moment in this space. And it's sort of a space my business is moving into, where we're looking at creating high quality composts and even taking, you know, inoculants from under a healthy tree in a forest, and then brewing up those good fungi bacteria, and then actually then putting it onto other plants to help them out, especially old heritage and veteran trees that we've got a lot of in Melbourne. Yeah. So, yeah, it's a really interesting space.
I think that there's a bit of a trap here for anyone who's just listening to this and going, oh, I'm just going to go and brew my own compost tea. Because again, like you're saying, it's all about how are you going to get that oxygen into that water, right?
Yeah, the oxygen, but also, and then also how are you going to get it into the subsoil? You can inject it. You can actually just put it down into the mulch. There's other ways to do it. So you can flood the area and let it drain down into it. So there's lots to it. Look, it's quite a complex process, but look, if people want to add organic matter into their soil, that's a good thing they can't get wrong, really.
Yeah. The problem with inoculants, everyone can't just go and do it.
Yeah, they can have a play, I mean, if they want to and learn, but the challenge is, people think, you know, what is the source that you're getting, and what are you actually trying to expand, and is it for grass or is it for trees? As I mentioned, fungal dominant for trees and grasses are bacterial dominant. So you need actually a little bit of knowledge about it. And I've been in this space for 20 something years and I'm learning. So we never stop learning. Yeah. So the point is, you know, if we can increase the organic matter in the soil by 1% over a hectare, we can increase the water holding capacity of that soil by 100,000 litres. If you can work that out, that's a lot of water. So having more organic matter in the soil, whether it's compost, manures, whatever it might be, really makes a big difference to the ability of that soil to retain moisture, to release nutrients and a lot of things. So, yeah, it's quite a complex thing. But, look, I encourage people to have a look into it and learn about it. Like I said, I'm still learning. I think a lot of people are. But we're trying to work out how we can fix highly damaged urban soils so we can get better tree growth. And the first thing you can do is take the grass composition out from your tree if you've got a tree that's suffering, put some compost under it and then mulch it and then give it some water. It's those sort of things. They're all pretty basic things, but each layer that you put on of what I call management, you'll get a response, and the more you put in, the more response you get. I'm looking at my window at my home now at some Chinese elms I planted around my house to shade it, a new house I built, and these trees are 5 meters tall by 4 meters wide, and they were planted as 45 liter stock 2 years ago into a very well prepared garden bed. And we had an excavator in and we dug down 600 deep and we put in a whole lot of a couple of ton of compost, manure, small potting mix, and we raised a garden bed and we put in drip irrigation and mulched it, and those trees are growing exponentially faster than other trees that you just dig a hole and shove a tree in. So if you do a bit of soil preparation and work, you can actually get very good results, to the point where, these trees are growing very quickly. Like I've can't keep up with the pruning of them so quick. So, but that's all right. I'd rather be in that case than the trees just struggling and not putting on any growth. So, so yeah, with a bit of what I call horticultural management of the soil and preparation, you can actually get very good growth of trees very quickly. And so, you know, that's some of the stuff I'm now working on with a few developers who want to go to the next level with their trees and create parks with, you know, big shade trees and such. So you can do it. It just takes a bit more effort and a bit more knowledge. Yeah,
and a bit more money.
Yeah, money, yeah. It makes the trees more expensive per tree, but when they're growing well and they're established and they're looking great, well, then you sort of get that benefit straight away. Rather than waiting 15, 20 years, you get it in 5 and 10, you know. So from that perspective, you know, and that's what a lot of these urban tree trenches and passive irrigation and structural soils can do to get tree growth. I've got projects I've worked on where I've got trees we planted back in the end of the drought, 2007, I think it was, a millennium drought. And these trees now, if you look at them, they're basically, 10, 16 years old, but they look like they're 35, 40 years old because they've just been put into a really good growing conditions. So they're getting well watered, getting plenty of nutrients, and they're happy. So from that perspective, they're growing really well, and you get this sort of really big tree canopy quickly, which is what a lot of people want, but you've got to do a bit of work to get to it.
So while we're on that topic, is there any way to calculate the amount of, you know, root zone that we need to provide for a tree?
Look, there is an online calculator being developed in Australia. I haven't used it much because I always want to put in big shade trees. I just stick to that 30 cubic metres or 20% less if you put them in a trench. But that's just me because I like big trees. the reality is, you know, like I did a project in Broadmeadows with the city of Hume when I was there, when I came back from the study tour of North America. And we got about a quarter of what I asked for in regards to root volume. But the trees are growing really well. Like, you know, these Chinese elms, they look like they're 15 years old and not even 5 years old yet. They got big, fat, 20-centimetre trunks. They're 6 metres tall, 8 metres wide. They're already been pruned about six times to get them up over the footpath because they're growing so quickly. So, you know, what I say to people is don't get hung up on getting the magic figure that it should get. Just get more than what you would normally get and you'll get better results, because already when we plant trees in urban areas and you look at the city of Melbourne, they cut out a hole, they put a tree in, it grows, and you look at some of those plane trees and think, how the hell did they get that big? You know, what's it feeding on? Where's the roots going? You know, like I was in the city the other night on Sunday night and I saw some plane trees and they were like 2 meters diameter. I'm thinking, how the hell, where's this thing getting its sustenance from and water? And but it must be, so it's surviving. So I always say just try and get as much as you can get, you can get it the ideal figure. And there is an online calculator. I think it's just Google Tree Root Volume Calculator, I think it's called. And you can put in the species you want, how big you want it to get roughly, and then they'll tell you a volume based on a similar theory to the stuff I showed you earlier about the 30 cubic metres, but obviously species specific, because some trees don't need that much root volume to get, you know, to get up. So, yeah, so there's a couple of things you can find out about that. I always say just try and provide the biggest area and volume you can, and, you know, then you'll get, you know, and then once it's sort of the tree fully exploits that area, it may slow down its growth. It won't get as big, but it'll be a big tree and be well established.
Yeah, look, one of the other ways that we can reduce the amount of space that roots have is through foot traffic and compaction, like cars and stuff like that. I imagine that's like a massive issue that you see all the time, right?
Yeah, look, I see lots of people. A lot of people are sort of unaware of compaction. It's quite interesting. As a parks manager, I decided to actually go out with the mowing crew and the hort crew and spend some time with them to sort of understand what they do and what some of their issues they always bring to me about. To their surprise, and, you know, so I was out mowing and, you know, and I went along with the guys, just said, look, just treat me as another worker, and you know, I'm the boss. And so I went out a couple of times and observed a lot of things which was interesting, and, you know, like where they park their truck to maintain a park. And it's always under the biggest shade tree.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, so after that I said, right, no more trucks allowed in parks. Oh, we can't keep an eye on a truck. It's like, well, You can park it nearby and you can keep an eye on it. You know, at the end of the day, you know, the compaction from driving big trucks and you know, even mowers and tractors under trees over many years can add up. And that's why you'll see, you know, in a lot of the parks where I manage, big mulch beds under trees so that, you know, you don't have to mow for a start.
Yep.
There's no grass competition. And there's moisture retention and you're decompacting the soil just by having organic matter on top of the ground. So, you know, if you get worms into that space, and the biology will actually decompact the soil over time if you don't give it the competition of the grass. So that makes a big difference. So that's why a lot of councils after the drought were actually mulching trees out in quite big garden beds, and some still remain to this day in the city of Melbourne. And because, you know, they needed it. I mean, after a drought, the soil was actually, in some of the council areas, were actually was hydrophobic. So when it did rain, it just ran off. And so some of the councils actually were injecting soil wetting agents into the ground and putting more mulch to retain moisture so it didn't run off. It's interesting. You talk about the power of mulch and organic matter. I used to manage a couple of, but I had a couple of big red gums that were a bit stressed, and I noticed it was a park in a new development, and I went past the hot day and I noticed there was 20 cars parking under these big red gums. And I thought, okay, they obviously want shade. They don't realise that if it dropped a 10-ton limb, their car's stuff. But other than that, I just actually quietly went and fenced the park, stopped the parking, much to some of their dismay and upset. And I said, well, you can't park under those trees. They're protected and that's not protecting them. Anyway, and it was, this was during the drought. And so one of the trees was mulched and one of them wasn't. And I had a contractor come along with it, and we were supplementary watering some of these massive 400 or 500-year-old red gums with recycled water. And I said to him, could you bring your semi-trailer up to this street? And he backed it up to this tree, causing compaction, but not under the tree root zone, but obviously causing some compaction out in the turf area, 30,000 litres of water, which is a semi-trailer, and just opened up the pipe and basically released the whole 30,000 litres of water into this mulch zone, and not one drop of water came out the other side on the slope. And I thought, wow. And this, but mind you, this was 20 metres diameter. So it was a big root, big gum.
Yeah.
The tree was about 6 metres diameter trunk, and the tree was about 30 metres high. So it was a very, very big old red gum, but it had been mulched for a long time. And the effect of the mulch was that the soil was open and it was able to take up that water. So I told him to go and fill up again, and we came back to the other tree, which wasn't mulched. And we could not put 2,000 litres of water on that tree. It just ran off the ground.
Just ran off?
Yep. It just couldn't get into the soil. The soil was hydrophobic. And so we had to go and spray out the grass around that tree, mulch it, and wait 12 to 18 months. And then we came back, because it was still in the middle of the drought, and we actually put in 30,000 litres of water on that tree, and we could get it to stay and basically soak into the ground. And it made a huge difference to those trees. They were getting attacked by lerps, and they're also missing a lot of understory. So we planted a lot of the understory plants that attracts the birds, which like the lerps, and that's made a difference too. So that and watering and mulching, because people go, oh, but they didn't have mulch under them, you know, when the Aboriginals were here. And I said, yeah, but they didn't have cattle sitting under them for 100 years pooing in them under the red gums, which they did, because the cattle would camp under these red gums in the farm when it was a farm. So there's a lot of compaction caused by that. So we have to uncompact all that, and we did that by using mulch, organic matter, compost, and biology, insects, worms, nematodes and stuff that actually were living in their mulch. And that's why the water was able to soak in. So that's I always say to people, if in doubt, mulch, get rid of grass mulch. And even if it's only temporary to get the tree established, but mulch makes a huge difference to the growth of trees. Yeah, I can't emphasize enough. And I still use mulch all the time. Yeah.
I guess you and I are going to take this for granted, but one of the biggest mistakes that I've seen with mulch is when people volcano mulch, or they call it the cone of death, where they sort of mulch up right up along that stem.
Yeah, that's a bit of a problem. You've got to keep it back from the stem. And the other problem is also that a lot of people, when they plant the tree, they bury the taper at the root ball as well.
That's planting too deeply, like you brought up before.
Yeah, but also sometimes the nurseries actually have them planted too deep.
Yeah.
So you've got to use a sort of a reputable nursery who knows what they're doing. And look, there's a lot of the nurseries are getting a lot better with tree growing. But you're right. Mulch volcanoes is not the way to go. We need, and when I mulch trees, we create a soil berm to hold water in the tree when it's establishing, and we have very little mulch over the root ball, like a thin layer, maybe an inch, and then over the actual berm we put it up a little bit, but it's certainly not up against the trunk. And if people, you know, people then I see people come put their lawn clippings on it, and you know, I just kick it all out, and when they come out and they go, "Who did that?" and I go, "I did." And they go, "Why?" "Because it's not good for the tree. It's composting the trunk." I said, "Come and have a look." Yeah. And they go, "Oh, okay, yeah, it's rotting it." I said, "Yes." So please refrain from doing that. Go get a green bin from council. "Oh, that costs money." I said, "Yeah, $50 a year or whatever it is. It's worth it. Otherwise, you're going to kill these trees." "Oh, I don't want to kill the trees. I thought I was helping." Like, no. And that's what mulch is, already composted material. So it's actually not going to heat up, whereas grass clippings, which are fresh, do compost and heat up and do damage to trunks. So when I'm maintaining trees, if I see lawn clippings, I'll just kick them all over the lawn, and usually I'll get a rude, you know, email from someone saying, "Oh, this guy kicked my grass out." It's like, well, you know, it shouldn't be there. So, you know, some people confront me and I just tell them and they go, "Okay, fair enough, thank you." You know, there's still some are not happy still, but, you know, some people you can't make happy. So anyway.
That's it.
Yeah.
So, you know, you're talking about the clippings there. I'm a big fan of the mulch mowing method. I know that there are some downsides in terms of, you know, spreading weeds and that. But, you know, we're going to be getting some of that organic matter back into the soil again. So it's going to help with the compaction that we've caused, especially with a ride-on mower that's going to cause quite a bit of compaction, right?
Look, it will cause a little bit more because there's a bit more weight. But they usually have fairly wide tyres, which spreads a load a bit. I mean, you know, certainly it's going to be more than a person walking with a push mower. You know, to me, mulch mowing is a way to go because, yeah, you're turning the organic matter into it. You may end up with a bit of a thatch layer in time, but that can be removed, you know, if you want to do that. But to me, it'll rot down and you know, if you cut it up fine enough and return some of that nutrient back into the soil rather than taking it off site, which is probably not a good thing either. So I don't disagree with you with that idea.
Yeah, let's just move on to the next one then. No more need for discussion.
Cool.
So is there anything we can do to remediate compaction after it's already, like, occurred?
Yeah. I mean, obviously avoiding it in the first place is the best idea. But look, simply, I mean, that example about the red gum with the mulch, mulch over time with grass removed can basically increase biodiversity of the flora, you know, the bacteria and fungi and the and nematodes and worms and such, to the point where they actually do a lot of the decompacting naturally. It does take longer. There are mechanical means. You can inject air into the soil. There's machines that'll do stuff. And, you know, it depends on, you know, how close you are to the tree and how much damage you want to do. There are other ways where we've actually done what we call radial trenching, where we actually dig a trench, radiating out from the trunk, try not to damage too many roots, and then replace that soil with compost. And so the roots will grow into that new zone that's decompacted, and then the turf will quickly cover it if you've got turf or mulch, if you've got mulch. But, yeah, so you radiate space, and that's beyond the drip line. So you might go up to not the structural root zone of the tree, but within sort of a couple of metres of the tree and dig a trench, trying to avoid any major roots, down to 300 or 400 and remove the compacted soil. You will damage a few roots, but if you do, you just cut them cleanly. And then you put in compost, you can put in manure. I put in a product called Worm Hit, which is basically worm castings compressed into a fertilizer like Dynamic Lifter, and that has worm eggs and stuff in it. And then basically you then cover that over with either the mulch or if it's a turf area, back put the turf back that you took off, and the tree will then invade that space as a new sort of, well, I suppose, fluffed up zone, and the trees can then grow into that. And you can do that a couple of times. You know, maybe 4 or 5 spokes a time, and just move them a little bit each time, and you'll end up with a less compacted area and a lot more biology there doing the work. But I think the biggest thing is taking away, you know, and I love turf, but not up against trees. Taking out the turf is a big thing, and then putting in mulch. And just that breaking down of mulch and that process does a lot of decompaction in its own right. But yeah, there's a couple of strategies there you can use.
And I noticed that when we've been talking about, you know, these soil issues, including the compaction and the hydrophobicity, you haven't mentioned clay breakers or soil wetters. Is that on purpose, or what's the go there?
No, look, I you can, I mean, clay breakers or even the addition of organic matter into clay is a slower process of doing that. I've used wedding agents and gels and things. Like some of the developers, when they plant trees, they specify a product called Terracotta, which has scoria and a whole lot of hormones and nutrients and gels and things in it that actually you mix in the backfill of the soil for the tree to grow in. And I've used that product a lot, and it does make a difference to the frequency of watering required, because the soil that you've backfilled in that's all fine now has other products in it that can retain water. So there is a space for that sort of stuff. I've just sort of in the last probably 10 years sort of gone down the more organic path, using organic matter composts and worm castings and stuff like that to do the job in a slower fashion, but probably more the way things should be done.
Yeah, thinking in tree time.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, long term. Yeah, I mean, it does take a while for it to kick in, but when it does, it's better for the tree, and it's more organic and natural and more sustainable too.
Mm. So earlier on in this episode, you talked about how the conditions in the west are different to the conditions in the east of Melbourne.
Yep.
Now, obviously, around Australia and around the world, we're going to have completely different soil types. But can you tell us about some of the other common issues you see around the Melbourne area and in Victoria?
Well, it's interesting because, I've planted hundreds of thousands of trees in local government of streets and parks and re-veg and such. And it's interesting, in a wet year, like we've had in the last 2 years, we've had a La Nina effect. We've had higher than above average rainfall. We've actually had loss of trees through waterlogging, which is which is like the opposite issue. But there are strategies you can do to deal with that as well. And one of them can be planting the root ball higher than the surrounding soil, so that when an area isn't inundated, that the tree roots still have some space that's not inundated, if you understand what I'm saying.
Mm.
And so that's something that can be done. So that's if you've got and this is what a lot of people don't look at when they plant. They go, is this a drainage line we're planting into? And I see a lot of people, they design swales and they put the tree right in the bottom of the swale. And sometimes you can't establish trees in the bottom of the swale because it's always wet.
Yeah.
It sounds stupid, but, like I had some where I had to plant the tree in the middle of February when it was the hottest time of the year to actually get it to establish, because if I try to plant it in winter when you should, it's too wet and the tree can't breathe because, as I mentioned earlier in the discussion, trees need oxygen, their roots need oxygen. So if they can't get oxygen because it's filled with water, then they will die, because how long can you hold your breath for? Not long. And the roots are the same. So that's why I actually had more trees die from waterlogging in those wet years than I did from drought in the dry years. It's interesting, because I used to go along to other councils and we'd talk about tree planting, and people go, in the drought. Actually, I went to a tree meeting with a whole lot of people, and someone said, "Who's stupid enough to plant trees in the drought?" And I chucked my hand up. And one of the guys said, because they went around and they were asking, how many trees were people planting, and this was in the 2000. Sort of 2004 to 2007 dry period when we had like 5 or 6 years of drought. And I just said, "We should be planting trees now." "Oh, but how do you get water?" I said, "Well, we get recycled water. We use recycled water. We tanker it to the trees and we water them. We can get them established." I said, I lose more trees in a wet year than I do in a dry year because I can't stop waterlogging, but I can water a tree if it's dry. I can't unwater it.
Isn't that the truth?
Yeah, well, you can't, because if it's water's there, it's there. You can't vacuum it up. Whereas if it's dry, and you can always add water. Some of these people were saying, "Oh, we're planting 400 trees a year, and we're doing this." And the city of Geelong said, "Oh, we're not planting trees until water restrictions lift." Because, yes, there's water restrictions, but you can use that recycled water. We had access to recycled water, and a lot of our open space at Hume was actually watered with recycled water. Some of these councils, like the city of Geelong, for example, and I probably shouldn't name them, but anyway, they actually said, "Oh, we're not going to plant until water restrictions are finished." And I said, "Well, you know, you're going to be planting for a long time." And I said, "And how many trees have you, what's your vacancy rate on nature strips?" And they said, "Oh, we've got 60% vacancy on nature strips," which means that for every 10 nature strips, 6 of them don't have a tree. And I go, "Well, you need to be planting, mate." And they go, "Yeah, but we've got no water." I said, "Well, recycle water. I'm sure your water authority would have access to Oh, but it costs money. I said, yeah, yes, it does. It costs money to establish trees. They're not free. And, you know, so, but, you know, so you'd have to water them for the first year or two, especially, you know, the native ones, 1 year, you water them, they're off. Some of the indigenous stuff, some of the exotic stuff, you might have to water for a couple more years, but you can do it and you can get trees growing. Because when they were planting 300 or 400 trees, when I told them I was planting 5,000 trees a year, they all looked at me like I was an alien. I go, what are you doing that for? Because we need trees. I said, when I first started at council at Hume, they were planting 400 trees and cutting down 4,000 a year. So we're going backwards 3,600 trees a year. So I had to turn that around. And look, we were still, even when I left, you know, 18 years later, we're still cutting down 3,000 or 4,000 trees a year, but we were planting 5,000 trees a year and developers were planting 10,000 new trees a year. So we were always, we're getting a net gain in trees, but we're going backwards in a hurry in the early days. And so, you know, I mean, those numbers are huge and 5,000 trees a year is a lot of trees. It's a lot of work and it's a lot of money. But the council was committed to it and we were getting 95% to 98% survival of our trees
in the drought. That's very good.
And those figures and the ones that didn't survive were usually ones that were vandalised, which we couldn't do anything about anyway. So, you know, so really we were probably getting close to 100%. It's just some people didn't want a tree or they want to park their truck on the nature strip or whatever, so they pull the tree out or, you know, vandalise it, whatever. But you know, I had one instance on a school in Coolaroo where I planted this street 5 times over 10 years and I finally, the kid who was pulling out the trees must have left high school and left them alone and I got them up and you get in that street now and it's got all these really nice looking trees and I won.
You won.
Persistence paid. Because they didn't pull out all of them. They just snap a few or break a few or whatever or back over and whatever they did.
I've seen it too.
Yeah, it happens. I'm not sure what the benefit to people is ruining trees.
It's a delinquency thing. I saw this one kid one time just beating a tree with a stick, and I was just like, actually working in the park in the uniform, and I was like, hey, buddy, don't do that. You're hurting the tree. And the look on his face was, it was like he hadn't even considered that he was actually doing damage. It was just he was playing Batman and Robin in his head or whatever.
Yeah. Look, a lot of people, I don't think they think about it too much. It's interesting. I mean, it's good that you did pipe up and hopefully you'll think a bit differently about it. But I'm not sure why people, you know, think they have the right to vandalise public property anyway. To me,
you can't think about it for too long.
You get a bit depressed otherwise. But you just keep planting. And that's what I did. I kept planting. So for 18 years at Hume, we planted 5,000 trees. And still to this day, and I've left, they're still planting 5,000 trees a year, every year. So that's a lot of trees.
What do they say? The best time to plant a tree is 10 years ago, and the next best time to plant a tree is today.
Correct. Yeah, no, I every day I plant a tree is a good day. It's a bit hot to do it at the moment, and there's times to do it. Like the best time for planting at our part of Melbourne is basically autumn break. Once the autumn break hits and it cools down and we get a bit of rain, so around April, May through to about September. And after that, it's either too hot or too dry, unless it's a wet year. So that's a fairly big window. So basically autumn, winter, early spring. And then after that, we don't recommend planting unless you're going to be watering weekly or even daily, depending on the size of the tree. I've planted some trees. You know, I've planted tube stock right through to 3,000-litre root ball, 10-metre-high trees. And obviously they all have different requirements with water, aftercare, follow-up and how much they need to get established. I planted trees with cranes and excavators. So that's fun and instant, but it's a bit of a head stress. But, you know, the results are amazing if you do it right.
No doubt. I can only imagine the logistics of trying to get it on the road and get it from here to there.
Oh, well, I mean, you know, when you can fit 5 trees on a semi and they're all intertwined, then you stand them up, put them on the crane, have the holes all prepared, drop them on their little stage, backfill with really nice soil, put in the irrigation system and off you go. So, yeah, it's a lot of work, but the rewards are pretty amazing.
We had these giant Canary Island palms removed from near me in Glen Huntly recently because of the train works. Oh, my goodness. Did you see that?
Yeah, no, I've seen some of that work happening.
Spectacular. Yeah, it was pretty cool to watch.
They'll come and put some of them back, won't they, I think?
Hopefully. Yeah, yeah, they're in a nursery somewhere. They're giant. Yeah. I have no idea how tall they were.
Well, I mean, basically, yeah, they've got big trunks. I mean, basically, they're big grass palm trees. I mean, they're a monocot.
Yeah,
and, monocots. And they don't have a lot of big root system, so they're not too hard to transplant because they don't have any secondary growth on their roots. So you can take a fairly small root ball for a big tree and
they'll survive. They were small. Yeah. Tidy little things.
Yeah. No, they'll be right to look after them.
No, yeah, and they had the fronds up in a little man bun.
Yeah, that's why they don't get wrecked and caught up in the tram lines and stuff. And yeah, no, look, hopefully they'll be, you know, once those works are done and they've prepared the site and put in some nice new uncompacted soil, hopefully they'll take off again.
Yeah, I think the housing market just changed among the lorikeets and the birds around because, yeah, I don't know where they're going to live after those Canary Island palms went.
Yeah, well, they're certainly a big food source for the seed. You know, and, yeah, lots of birds live in them. But, I mean, you know, birds are adaptable. They'll find somewhere new nearby, hopefully.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's a lot of planting going on by councils and community around the place, and I hope we can encourage more people to do it on their own land. You know, if you plant two shade trees on the north or west side of your house, you can actually save power through air conditioning by just cooling your house and shading it. So there's, you know, little things like that you can do to actually, you know, help your own environment and cool. A lot of people don't realise it, you know. I think you can't have too many trees is my motto.
100%, mate. So I've got two more questions for you.
Sure.
The first one is, why are you a member of the Australian Institute of Horticulture?
Why am I a member? Good question. Look, I've actually studied, I didn't go back. I studied at Burnley back in the early 90s. So I did a Bachelor of Applied Science in Horticulture. And then I specialised, at the time you could do arboriculture, nursery production or environmental horticulture as a major. I did all three. Because I was told I couldn't, so I said, I'll watch it. And so I did, much to the disgust of the principal at the time, who I think I started the trend because a lot of other people started doing it. But anyway, I mean, I had a lot of subjects. But look, I see myself as a horticulturalist, but I also did a master's degree in forest science by research. So I'm a forester as well. So I'm a horticulturalist, a forester, and an arborist. So I'm a qualified arborist. So I can have to climb trees and I do reports and stuff. But I identify as a horticulturalist because arboriculture is a stream of horticulture.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I think I think we need to encourage more people to get into the industry because there's a lot of opportunities and it's a very broad industry. There's so many things you can go into. I thought I'd better join and get involved because I've been threatening to for years. But you know, being in local government, I was in a lot of other organisations, Parks and Leisure Australia, World Urban Parks and stuff like that. But, you know, I wanted to get back to my horticulture route. So I only rejoined probably about 3 years ago when I started the business. Mm-hmm. And then, started getting invited. I got invited to speak, which was great. And I got to meet a whole lot of new friends and people, which was even better. And, I mean, I still know a lot of people in the industry because at my role in council, I used to buy lots of trees. So I know a lot of the tree growers. But now, recently, I've actually joined the NGIV, the Nursery Garden Industry Victoria, and the Tree and Shrubbies Group, to learn from other growers about how to grow trees. So, you know, like all these groups, you learn different things from. I learned a lot at the seminar, even though I spoke at it, but I learned a lot from other people. So, and made new connections, and you know, still keep in touch with them. I'll go out of that. I caught up with Clarence Slocky from Gardening Australia, and obviously Costa. And Clarence has had me on a few jobs consulting online into Sydney to help with some of the tree stuff. So I've got a bit of work out of it. So, you know, I wasn't the expected reason to join, but it's a good benefit. But no, I think, you know, adding to the industry is important, you know, adding to knowledge and, you know, helping organise things. Like I reckon in a couple of years I'll probably put my hand up to be, you know, on the committee to help with things if they want. I've had a lot of experience in that space through other organisations. So people come from various different disciplines and stuff, and we all learn from each other. And, you know, when I joined the NGIV and the Tree and Shrubbies because I really like Melbourne International Flower and Garden Show, and they help organise that. So I'm probably going to be more involved with that in the future in some way or form, and hopefully more involved with the AAH and encourage more people to study horticulture. I think as an industry we need to promote what we do, which is, you know, greening, really, fundamentally, and we need to promote it as a career path and get more people interested in it. A lot of people want to, you know, help save the world. Well, this is a practical way you can do it. And, you know, if you can learn to be a horticulturalist or an arborist or a nursery production person or whatever, you can grow plants, you can plant them, you can care for them. There's so many different streams in horticulture. And I people in the horticultural game, and you know this, they're the salt of the earth people. They're really, you know, great people, mm-hmm. and they share their knowledge and experience without question. Like if, you know, you ask them a question, you think, oh, should I ask this? And they go, yeah, I'll tell you. What do you want to know? You know, and then they share their secrets about how they grow certain things and, you know, and help you out. And they're willing to do that. And that's, I don't think there's many industries that are like that. So from that perspective, I thought I'd better join and, have a look back and join it.
Yeah, good stuff. So the final question I always like to ask everybody, it doesn't have to be on topic. It's basically just, is there anything else you'd like people to know about?
Oh, anything I like? Look, I'll keep it on topic because I like trees. I think we just, you know, like I've got, it's interesting, when my wife's a forester and we met at Melbourne University when she was studying forestry and I was doing my master's. So we're tree people. So when our kids were born, much to the disgust of the nurses, we asked to keep the placenta from the birth of our kids to plant under a tree. So each of my kids, and I've got three of them, one's about to turn 18 in a couple of weeks. One's 15 and my youngest is 13, I think. And they've all got a tree planted when they were born by myself and my mum and their mum with a placenta from their birth next to the tree. So that's their tree. And, you know, I reckon we should do that for every person born. And, you know, like, and if we did that, I reckon we save the world one tree at a time. You know what I mean? Yeah. And then for every birthday, if you plant another tree somewhere else, think of all the trees we'd be planting. You know, like, so I just think plant more trees. If you've got a bit of dirt and you're not sure what to do with it, plant some trees. And it's not just that I grow trees and I look after them. I think, you know, trees are good and, you know, we can't have too many trees. That's my addition. Hopefully that's all right.
Plant more trees. I love it. Thank you so much for your time, Jason. Really great episode, man.
Well, I appreciate it. Thanks for the questions. And, hopefully they're useful for someone.
Let's focus on planting trees properly and thinking in tree time instead of rushing to plant them as quickly and cheaply as possible and then wondering why they aren't performing. Check the show notes to follow Jason on LinkedIn, view the Remarkable Trees website, or become a member of the Australian Institute of Horticulture. If a career in amenity horticulture, arboriculture, or parks and gardens is something you're pursuing, head to hortpeople.com, the Australian Garden Industry Job Board. You deserve a better job than the one you have right now.